Dana sues the estate of the late Mr. Reyes in federal court. She wants to tell the jury one sentence. Mr. Reyes personally promised to pay me $40,000. There is no document, no other witness, and the one person who could contradict her is in the grave. May she say it? It depends on something that has nothing to do with Dana. Why is she in federal court? If this is a diversity case and state law governs the claim, a state dead man's statute can silence her completely. If it is a federal question case, those same words are perfectly competent testimony. That is this episode. Once evidence is relevant and authentic, a second set of rules takes over, and they are the plumbing of the trial itself. Here is the root, and it is really five questions. Who is allowed to testify? What happens when a witness blanks? Can a juror blow up the verdict afterward? Can the court skip proof entirely? And when one exhibit is fair for one purpose and forbidden for another, how do we fence it off? None of this is starred, so the exam may hand you the rule. Question 1. Who may testify? Competency asks something narrow. Is this person legally allowed to be a witness at all? Centuries ago, the answer was often no. Felons, atheists, spouses, children, and anyone with money at stake were disqualified on sight. Modern law threw nearly all of that out. Under FRE 601, the default is radical inclusion. Everyone is competent. A witness who is young, forgetful, biased, or a convicted criminal still takes the stand, because those concerns go to weight, not competency. Weight is what you argue to the jury and test on cross. Competency is the bare minimum needed to testify at all. That minimum is four things. Personal knowledge. Under FRE 602, the witness must have actually perceived the matter firsthand. An oath or affirmation. Under FRE 603, in some form that presses on the conscience. No magic words. No religious reference required. The ability to communicate, under FRE 604, using a qualified sworn interpreter if needed. And an understanding of the duty to be truthful. That last one is why a 6-year-old can be questioned briefly before testifying, just to confirm the child knows the difference between a truth and a lie. Not whether the child is a good witness, only whether the child grasps the obligation. And one more, FRE 610. A witness's religious beliefs cannot be used to boost or attack their credibility. Now the one big wrinkle, hiding in the second sentence of FRE 601. In a civil case, when state law supplies the rule of decision, state law also governs competency. That sentence is the gateway to dead man's statutes. A dead man's statute is a state law with a narrow target. It stops an interested survivor from testifying about a conversation or transaction with someone who has since died. The testimony has to be offered against that person's estate. The worry is obvious. The one witness who could contradict the survivor is in the grave, so the law silences the survivor to prevent one-sided, unanswerable claims. Which is Dana. The federal rules contain no dead man's statute of their own. But because FRE 601 defers to state law on competency, a state statute can control in federal court whenever state law supplies the rule of decision. So, watch for the combination. A diversity case, a state law claim by or against an estate, and an interested witness testifying about private dealings with the decedent. Change it to a federal question case and the statute drops out entirely. Two special players finish competency. Under FRE 605, the judge presiding over a trial may not testify in it. The roles are incompatible. Notice the kindness built into that rule. It is automatic, so no party has to object, because objecting to the judge, in front of the judge, is exactly the awkward trap the rule spares you. and under FRE 606A, a sitting juror cannot testify in the case they are hearing. If someone tries to call one, the court must let the parties object outside the jury's hearing, so the objection itself does not taint the panel. That is the easy half of FRE 606. Question 2, and this is the heavily tested half. After a verdict, a losing party often discovers something troubling about how the jury got there and wants a juror to sign an affidavit blowing it up. FRE 606B, the no impeachment rule, slams that door. Verdicts need finality, and jurors must deliberate candidly without fear of being hauled back. So the rule draws one bright line. What happened inside the jury's collective head and deliberations is barred. Outside influences that improperly invaded the jury room are allowed. Three narrow exceptions let a juror testify. Extraneous, prejudicial information reached the jury, an outside influence was brought to bear, or a mistake was made entering the verdict onto the form. So, test the line. A juror read a news article about the case, or consulted a dictionary, or did outside research. In or out? In. That is extraneous information from outside the room. Now the other side. Two jurors dozed off, a third drank from a flask, and several admitted they never understood the instructions on burden of proof. All barred. Sleeping, drinking, misunderstanding instructions, compromising by averaging numbers, a juror admitting they never really believed the evidence. Every one of those is internal, and no affidavit about them may even be received. The condition of a juror inside the room is not an outside influence, however dysfunctional it sounds. There is one more exit, and it comes from the Constitution rather than the rule. Suppose a juror makes a clear statement showing that racial animus was a significant motivating factor in the vote to convict a criminal defendant. The Sixth Amendment right to an impartial jury then overrides the no impeachment rule. Keep that exception in its lane. It is a criminal case, racial bias rule. Do not stretch it to jurors who were merely confused or unfair. Question 3. What happens when a witness blanks? Witnesses forget, and the lawyer may jog the memory. This is present recollection refreshed, under FRE 612, and the key insight is that the memory-jogging item is not evidence. It is a spark, not a fact. The witness looks at something, the memory floods back, the item is taken away, and the witness testifies from refreshed memory. Because the item is never offered for its truth, almost anything will do. A police report, a photograph, a diary, a song, even a leading question. It need not be admissible, authenticated, or even the witness's own document. Now notice an asymmetry that surprises people. The party doing the refreshing does not get to publish the document to the jury. It is the adverse party who gains rights to see the item, cross-examine on it, and put the relevant parts into evidence. That stops a lawyer sneaking inadmissible material in front of the jury under cover of just refreshing. And here is the classic trap. FRE 612 against FRE 803-5, past recollection recorded. They look alike and do opposite things. So try it. A witness reads a report, and the memory comes flooding back. Which one? Refreshing. She testifies from memory and the report stays out of evidence. Now the witness reads it and still cannot recall a thing. That is recorded recollection, a hearsay exception. If the witness once knew the facts and made or approved an accurate record while they were fresh, the record can be read aloud to the jury. But it becomes an actual exhibit only if the opponent offers it. One-line test. Did looking at the document bring the memory back? Yes is FRE 612. No is FRE 803-5. Question 4. Was the error preserved? Trial mistakes only help you on appeal if you kept them alive, and FRE 103 is the rule book. It splits into two mirror images. If the judge lets in evidence you think is bad, you object, on the record, in time, and with the specific reason. A vague objection that names no ground usually preserves nothing. If instead the judge keeps out evidence you wanted, objecting makes no sense. You make an offer of proof. Outside the jury's hearing, you tell the judge what the excluded evidence would have shown, which is exactly what Dana's lawyer must do the moment the dead man's statute silences her. Say nothing, and the appellate court never learns what she would have said. Two mechanics finish preservation, definitive rulings. If the judge rules for good on a motion in limine, you need not object again at trial. A tentative ruling must be renewed, or you waive it. And the standards of review. Most evidence rulings get abuse of discretion. A preserved error is reversed only if it was harmful. An unpreserved error gets only plain error. Question 5, first half. Can the court skip proof? Some facts are so obviously true that proving them with live witnesses wastes everyone's time. Judicial notice lets the court accept such a fact as established without formal evidence. FRE 201 governs adjudicative facts, the who did what, when, where facts specific to this case. A court may notice a fact only if it is not reasonably disputable, and there are exactly two routes to that certainty. Generally known within the court's territorial jurisdiction, or readily and accurately determinable from sources whose accuracy cannot reasonably be questioned. A calendar date, a tide table, that two named cities are about 300 miles apart. What it cannot notice is whether the traffic light was red, because that is disputed and case-specific. The court may notice on its own, and must notice when a party requests it and supplies the information. It can happen at any stage, including for the first time on appeal. Now the wrinkle the exam loves. Once a fact is noticed, how binding is it? Try it. A civil jury is told the court has noticed that two cities are 300 miles apart. Must they accept it? Yes, conclusively. Now the same fact, same certainty, in a criminal prosecution. The jury may accept it, and is not required to. The reason is constitutional. A criminal defendant has the right to have the jury decide every element, and a court cannot direct a finding against the accused, even on an obvious fact. So carry two words, must in civil, may in criminal. Question 5, second half. Evidence often has a split personality, admissible for one purpose but not another, or against one party but not a co-party. Rather than exclude it, the law admits it and fences off the improper use with a limiting instruction. Under FRE 105, when evidence is admissible for one purpose but not another, the court, on timely request, must restrict it and instruct the jury accordingly. The catch is in those two words, timely request. The instruction is not automatic. If nobody asks, the court has no duty to give it, and the evidence comes in for all purposes. Classic examples. A prior inconsistent statement admitted to impeach, but not as substantive proof. A prior act admitted to show motive, under FRE 404B, but not bad character. Two companions worth knowing. First, the limiting instruction has limits. Under the Confrontation Clause, a non-testifying co-defendant's confession that names the defendant cannot be cured by telling the jury to ignore it. Some evidence is too prejudicial to unring. Second, FRE 106, the rule of completeness. If one side introduces part of a statement to create a misleading impression, the other side may at that moment require the rest. After the 2023 amendment, even over a hearsay objection, and even for oral statements. A word on authorities, because this episode named no cases, and that was deliberate. Everything here lives in the federal rules of evidence, and because none of it is starred, the exam may hand you the rule text itself. There is nothing to cite from memory. There is a great deal to recognize. If you keep only three things, keep these. FRE 606B, and the line between what happened inside the jury's head and what invaded from outside. FRE 612 against FRE 803-5, which turns on a single question: did the memory come back? And FRE 201, where a civil jury must accept the noticed fact and a criminal jury only may. Now the traps. 1. Refreshing versus recorded recollection. If the memory comes back, it is FRE 612, and the writing stays out. If it does not, it is the FRE 803-5 hearsay exception, and the record is read to the jury. 2. The refreshing document does not come into evidence for the party doing the refreshing. Only the adverse party may admit it. 3. A bare objection preserves nothing. You need the specific ground and an offer of proof for excluded evidence. 4. After a definitive in limine ruling, you need not renew, but a tentative ruling must be renewed. 5. Juror testimony. Misunderstanding instructions, compromising, or being intoxicated are all internal and barred. Only extraneous information, an outside influence, a verdict form clerical error, or clear racial animus in a criminal case can impeach a verdict. 6. Judicial notice is conclusive in civil cases and only permissive in criminal ones. And 7. A limiting instruction is not automatic. It must be requested, and it cannot cure a confrontation clause violation. Time for the quick check. This one comes straight from the BARGO question bank. At a civil trial, the court admits a witness's prior inconsistent statement. On these facts, it is admissible to impeach the witness's credibility, but not as substantive proof of the matter asserted. Defense counsel, focused on other issues, never asks the court for any instruction restricting how the jury may use it. The jury treats the statement as substantive evidence. After losing, the defendant argues on appeal that the court erred by failing to limit its use. Did the trial court err? Option 1. Yes, because the court must always limit evidence admitted for only a single purpose. Option 2. No, because a limiting instruction is required only on a party's timely request. Option 3. No, because once admitted, a prior inconsistent statement may be used for any purpose. Pause here if you want a moment. The answer is option 2. Under FRE 105, the court must restrict the evidence and instruct the jury, but only on a timely request. The request is the trigger. A party who never asks cannot complain later, and the evidence comes in for all purposes by default. Option 1 puts a duty on the court that the rule does not create. Option 3 lands on the right result for the wrong reason. The statement became usable for everything only because nobody asked to cabinet. If option 1 felt obviously right, that is the instinct this rule quietly defeats. There are 30-plus more questions on this topic alone. 5 things to take away, 1 for each question. 1. Everyone is competent, and youth, bias, and convictions go to weight. What is required is personal knowledge, an oath, the ability to communicate, and an understanding of the duty to tell the truth. 2. Jurors may testify about extraneous information, outside influence, and clerical verdict errors, and about nothing else that happened in that room. 3. Ask whether the memory came back. Yes is refreshing, and the writing stays out. No is recorded recollection, and the record is read in. 4. Object with a specific ground and make an offer of proof for what was excluded. 5. Judicial notice binds a civil jury and never a criminal one, and a limiting instruction only exists if somebody asks. Which brings us back to Dana. Nothing about her testimony changes. The same sentence, the same dead man, the same $40,000. What changes is why she is in federal court. Find which mechanic is in play first. Next time, privileges and policy exclusions. Practice this topic with more than 2,900 exam-style questions, free to start, at nextgenbargo.com. This episode is for education and exam preparation only, not legal advice, and we are not affiliated with or endorsed by the NCBE or any bar examining authority.